But in any case, 115 Senate Finance, not here. So somebody else can go out here and remind me what I just said. Mr. Grunberg is with us as well. Mr. Sun, do you want to make an opening statement, and I'll let Katie, who has a bit of a health problem, make her presentation.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps
we'll deal with both bills in the package.
House Bill 509, which is the two-judge version for Palmer and Kenai, along with 515, which is the four-judge version, which is Palmer, Kenai, Ketchikan, and Fourth Judicial District. And I don't think it's any great news to this committee of some of the needs in some of the areas of the state. So I will withhold some of my persuasive arguments until later. We're all a little healthier, maybe, like Katie testified now, and I see Carlos here too. So.
Yeah, go ahead.
I will note in the files, I think there's a fiscal note from every portion of the criminal justice agency you can think of, and a couple that you haven't heard of before.
Anybody added those up? Yeah.
I got over $2 million and I quit. So.
For adding five judges?
Four in one bill and two in another.
Criminal justice planning, we've had so much fun putting that exercise together for us where they showed the interconnection, but they just gone wild.
I think they have a clearinghouse on their bills and a fiscal note somewhere.
Go ahead.
My name is Katie Hurley. I'm a representative from the Matsu District and have lived in that area for 25 years and have seen it grow from a little village of 5,000 people in the area to now over 30,000, and have watched the good job that Judge Cutler has been doing, but it's just overwhelmed. She's just overwhelmed with filings, and I submitted to you, and I won't go through all of the details of the support that she sent down, but to contrast to the numbers of filings of 6,374, so far in 85 as compared with Kenai, which also needs a judge, 4,249, and Juneau 2,975, and even Anchorage has only 2,720 per judge. So there is a real need there. I did want to add that it isn't just to get the judge. There is no place for the court building right now is inadequate for even the operation that is going on. And I just talked with the city manager of Palmer, who they have submitted a capital project for a court building, but they are also looking at a lease arrangement and are having a meeting tomorrow evening on and bonding for the court building is on their agenda. So they're not sitting around waiting for that grant. They have been working with the court system on the planning and with Judge Cutler. And I just want to let you know that there's a lot of support there in the community to try to get the building if there isn't money for a grant from the state. And any other questions that you may have, I think her letter is very, the one paragraph that I wanted to point out is where she says that they have only one superior court judge, no district court judge, and only one magistrate. And those statistics contrast with some of the areas where they have two. For instance, Juneau has two superior court judges and a district court judge, I believe. So it's, at the time that this was planned, there were not the number of people in the area, and so it's just happened almost overnight, and I know the court system is very supportive of doing the right thing for the people there.
Okay, do we have any questions for Attorney Burley? Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I am on the Representative Sun's bill also.
Oh, right. Carla, did you present to you this before? Sir? We'll just sort of continue to deal with both bills.
For the record, my name is Carla Forsyth, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. Mr. Chairman,
chairman, committee members, the court system looked at various requests for judgeships and tried to evaluate these requests in terms of the most pressing needs throughout the state in view of the declining oil revenues. And as a result, the court strongly supports both the Palmer and the Kenai judgeships based on significant population increases, significant increases in the labor force, significant increases in filings. The court system certainly has no objection to a Superior Court judgeship in Ketchikan. That is also a very busy court location, but the Rangel judge, who had been providing some assistance to Ketchikan, is spending a lot of time in Juneau. However, in the face of the current revenue situation, the court system cannot support the request for a Superior Court judgeship in Bethel. The statistics simply do not justify that additional position in the court system's view. I'll be glad to answer any specific questions that the committee might have.
Mr. Clark.
You have to forgive me, my voice is almost gone, but is it possible to quantify, is it possible to prepare an accurate analysis of caseloads for each judge throughout the state? We do that with social workers and lots of other things here to analyze where the need is based on the caseload. So can we do that for judges? And I understand you have to vary in the rural district with more travel and stuff. Can you tell me for each of the 29 Superior Court judges now what their caseload is?
Through the chair, it's not possible for me to do that right now, but we have the figures. We could do that. We have the statistics and filings for each court location.
And is that the kind of information you use in concluding you can't support one in Bethel, for example?
Yes, that's correct.
I guess I'd like to request that. I don't know what your plan is on this bill, but it really would be helpful to see that.
Well, the plan was not, and this is in conjunction with the Senate, it was not something to go up to anyway. I really wanted to get all the information we could, and then maybe a bill in the Senate, in which case we just need to be prompt. But we're going to do all the homework, and this is good. This comes up in this one because we'll be able to get that information perhaps before the other bill arrives here. So.
I want to clarify on that. Would you like us to prepare that information for every court location or simply for the court locations in question?
I'd like to see the caseload for each judge. And I understand you'd have to, there have to be some variables for those judges who also have the masters and magistrates working in their area. Those, of course, that have more travel in rural areas and such. And I mean, we need to take that into account, but you've got to start with the basic information about what their caseload is. Let me ask the question another way, maybe. Let's say we said we're going to add four more judges. Three of them, presumably Kenai, Palmer, and Ketchikan. Would Bethel be the fourth? Or is there some place that needs it worse than Bethel in your judgment?
In the court system's view, that the two most pressing locations are Palmer and Kenai. Ketchikan would come next, and there was some consideration given to Dillingham as a possible location. But again, the thought was that in view of the revenue picture, that was not something that the court wanted to request at this time.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, your Mr. Delaplane spoke in the memo here relative to the two function pretty well as a service in the service area concept. Yes, yeah. It's one of the attachments to this.
To which?
Well, Mr. Chairman, okay. I guess on in light of the request from President Fox, in terms of that, if you could also point out there which of the judges are presiding judges in their districts. I think that's one of the issues that Judge Schultz has brought up in Ketchikan, that he is the presiding judge for Southeast, and the administrative duties of taking care of that, plus the caseloads. That's time that he's required to put forth and put in that wouldn't show up in a case filing basis. And I'm sure that's the same with the other presiding judges who have administrative duties.
That has nothing to do with the bill, but I'm just curious, and your friend, how's Judge Schultz doing? Is he back on the bench?
I don't know, Mr. Chairman. I haven't spoken with him last week, so.
He had pneumonia last week.
Yeah, that's the interesting fact. Yeah, but spending 17 days selecting a jury, going to a 4-month trial, and then getting pneumonia before opening arguments.
Of course, it could have been worse. They could have been into the arguments and then getting pneumonia. Probably worse.
Mr. Chairman, I would just like to get the issue before this committee so that each of the members could get some questions or what areas of inquiry that they are concerned about out, and then we can research those.
Sure.
I have no doubt in my mind that Palmer is in a crisis type of situation, and the Kenai far behind it, but and that if you want to compare those two numbers to what Ketchikan and Southeast has, they're much higher numbers, but that doesn't mean that we should get ahead of the eight ball here before Judge Schultz says, you know, it's not going to work on weekends and nights anymore, and then it just turns over into another big problem.
Right. Mr. Taylor?
Does Dillingham have a district court?
No, it does not. It has a magistrate coach.
Just for the record, you know, all members of the committee are now present.
Well, I don't wish to jeopardize the bill. I'd like to make a comment to the committee on judgeships in general, and that is that since the first conversion, if you will, that occurred out in Kodiak from a superior to a, from a district court to a superior slash district court, we've attempted to follow that wherever we could throughout the state. That's why Judge Cutler is sitting as a superior slash district court judge at Palmer. That's why her caseload appears much higher than what the numbers would appear if we were functioning in a district court, superior court setting, because far and away those 6,000 cases are probably a lot more misdemeanors than our fellows or civil cases than our superior court jurisdiction. So if you were to separate out which are the district court filings and which are the superior court filings, the caseload might not appear quite as dramatic. I certainly support the need for the judgeship in the Palmer area, however, because I was there conducting that court on occasion just prior to the time that judgeship was created. It was one of the people who pushed very hard to see that judgeship created. But I'd like the Judiciary Committee to just keep in mind, and maybe we could even get a report, the fiscal note would probably blow us all away, but I'd like to see what a fiscal note would be for converting all of our district court judgeships into district or superior slash district, so we don't have to provide, so as to provide for a much greater degree of flexibility within the system to be able to take up the slack whenever you end up with a case like this Peel case in Ketchikan. If in fact we've done that, you're only probably talking of increasing the salaries in this district of two sitting judges. At this point, we only have two district court judges left. And you'd only be increasing those by what, 15,000? Roughly?
Yeah, I don't know off the top of my head. Something along those lines.
And for that $30,000 additional expenditure in our district, you would then have two additional people to fill in and pick up the caseload problems that flow out of the appeal case, as an example. Or having a judge sick for a given period of time. We've been very fortunate there. It could happen easily where we have someone incapacitated for 4 or 5 months due to illness. And when that happens in one judge locations or smaller communities, it really causes a big crunch because you have to end up shifting people around and per diem and all the rest of the problems, which then every time what happens in our district here in the First Judicial District is you're pulling a superior court judge out of a larger community that needs it, probably more than the one he's having to be shipped to. And somebody always gets caught in the crunch, the cases get delayed, and so on. Whereas it's just a small expenditure, really, per year. You can wipe out the distinction between the two. I think years ago there was a lot of reasons for that distinction. I think over the years, we've seen a much higher caliber of candidates applying for the district court bench. The requirements of years of service or years of practice have increased, and I just think it's something we should keep in mind. I'd like to have the fiscal note on it if we could.
Mr. Summers is going to have a question on Mr. Greenberg.
I guess, Carl, I just ask, what are the three or four critical items you look at when you're figuring out whether an area needs another judge or not? What are the, I know we have a few piles of statistics here, but what are the critical?
Representative Sun, I can just summarize the ones that are listed in there. Those are the factors, basically population increases, labor force increases, the number of law enforcement officers and attorneys, that would feed into that court location, the gross number of filings, and the percentage increases in those filings, as well as the breakdown between traffic and non-traffic filings. And generally, this would be compared against a one particular court location as a standard, and in this case, those figures were compared against Juneau as a standard to Superior Court Judge, one District Court Judge site.
Schoenberg and Phillips.
Yeah, I'd like to follow up on what Representative Taylor said. This came up about 10 years ago, a unified court system, and I think the feeling was at the time that the judge, the quality of caliber, with all due respect to my friend, your name was not among those mentioned, there was a difference in caliber. I don't see that as being a problem now. The thing that concerns me is the mechanism for melding these two into one. And I presume that if we have District Court Judge A sitting in Anchorage, that to meet the requirements of the Constitution, I think that person would then have to get reappointed and have to go through the entire process. And frankly, that might be a way of solving the problem in case there are other people who couldn't cut the mustard. I would like, Mr. Chairman, for the court system to take a look.
Don't touch that.
Nope.
No, Robin and I were having a conversation here.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about people who couldn't cut the mustard, and we're not talking about the representative from Wrangell.
Okay. If the members of the committee think this is a lousy idea.
No, continue.
We like it.
But what I would like to do is to see, and maybe this would be something for next session to put in or something, but the consideration of an omnibus bill to unify the court system, the district and the superior court, leaving in some circumstances the option open to maintain a strictly district court. Because I can see some people who are applying for the superior court are sitting on the superior court not wanting to try DWIs back-to-back for months on the end. And so this is something that is going to have to be handled very carefully.
Well,
if I may
just interject, the first DWI trial I had was in front of a Supreme Court justice.
Yeah.
Because of the pressure.
Sure. But I'm concerned that you might very well find some people who would be looking at it from the opposite point of view and saying, I'm the presiding judge of this judicial district and I don't want to spend all my time doing DWI. So we really do need to have some thoughts. And I don't know if the Chief Justice would be in a position to want to have a bill introduced at his request. That might be one of the ways of doing it. But we request that maybe that can be explored.
Go ahead and relay the interest in the subject. I don't think we want to get deep in that. That's not a bill before us. We can relay our interest in exploring that subject. We can see what develops. Mr. Clarkson, or Mr. Phillips, I know we don't want to talk about.
Well, how is it that a judge, and this is what we're talking on fiscal though, the benefits outstrip the salary? I know they have a pretty good retirement system, but I mean, the public, when they take a look at this, and especially mine, after being home this weekend, I don't think they're going to be too pleased about this. Do we have an answer for it?
The answer is the retirement system. Best retirement system in this country.
Is that what it is? The vast majority of it?
It is. It is
or all of it.
Mainly to retirement.
My next career.
Is this something?
I may be mistaken on this, but part of the high cost of the court system, right? Oh no, this is because these are new players. I was going to say we're going through a lot of catching up because the court retirement system was not put on an actuarial basis until about a year and a half ago, and there was a lot of expensive catch up. But these figures would not be in that category because these are new judges, so that should be actual cost for those judges.
Is this on an annual basis?
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is.
They have $82,000 salary and $96,000 in benefits annually?
I believe that's accurate. If that's what our fiscal note states, that is the figure.
I recognize the need, John, and out in your area, and particularly up in Palmer, but, the average guy is going to look at this mean, they ever get it. You know, I'm John Q. Public.
That's what they're paying right now.
I know that's what they're paying now. I know that.
I want you to know that we're adding more to the bureaucracy, and everybody's saying we've got to cut back in government and stuff like this, and you see $96,000 worth of benefits, because they too have salaries. I mean, how do you explain that?
I'd just like to know, Mr. Chairman, reading the fiscal note, the Superior Court judge in Ketchikan is the cheapest.
I know, I saw that. I saw that, John. I saw that, but I just want
to. I would also like to note that we don't have to build any new office space for the one in Ketchikan. We have a court building that could adequately take care of this person.
Yeah, okay.
So.
Maybe we should just pull the Ketchikan judge out.
Well, I, that maybe is a slight revision of my question.
Mm-hmm.
My question was, I suppose I could do it by going through these fiscal notes, but it seems to me, couldn't we develop a unit cost for this somehow? If you add a Superior Court judge in Palmer, and you go through the troopers and the Office of Public Advocate and anybody else, seems to me, couldn't we have a unit cost? It's a little easier to calculate this. And part of that unit cost is the question raised by Representative Sun, which of those would require a capital expenditure of some sort for a new office space. And I mean, it's not your proposal, so I'm not sure you're the one to ask, but on the other hand, there are 4, 5, 6 different fiscal notes, and if we could collect the information and develop a unit cost for each of them, it'd be easier for me to analyze whether it's just a...
Mr. Chairman, that's something that we can certainly pass along to the Criminal Justice Working Group and see if it is possible to come up with something along those lines.
I was just going to ask the other question, which you don't have to answer, but if you had an opportunity to review the fiscal notes from the others, and we have an opinion as to their accuracy?
I've not had an opportunity to review those. Those haven't been forwarded to the court system.
If we forwarded them to you, would you be likely to come up with an opinion?
Well, I guess three Superior
Maybe the Criminal Justice Working Group is a better place to refer those.
Can they always have a trooper? For each new judge, you always get one new trooper, but
call in prison.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I mean, generally that's the case,
yeah.
but there are circumstances when
sure.
it's not. I mean, there will be some variation. I mean, what might be possible is a unit cost with a range, a high and a low.
I just bring up a point, Mr. Chairman. One was, I asked Carl earlier, you know, what you look at in judgeships, and one was the number of police officers in the area, right? But on the other hand, they're saying they look at how many judges are in the area and give us a fiscal note to how many police officers they should put in. So it's kind of like one's leading the other one here. But yeah, they have a
although they didn't add anybody in Bethel.
Jones
did.
Let me tell you. I have a great Bethel story. I won't tell it right
now. I thought I'd heard all your Bethel.
So we're not having one in the 4th District then, or we are?
Well,
that's in the bill right now.
It's in the bill.
But it may not need to be.
But I also note that there's another bill on the Senate side and on the other body that has 3 judges in it. So it's proceeding a lot more.
And this was the idea. We just hear these bills today and we just wait for that bill to come across.
Right,
we're just going to change that information accumulated.
So we'll collect that information.
Is it agreed then that this, Carla, you're willing to prepare a unit cost analysis? Is that the appropriate request of you?
Well, Representative Faulkner, I don't know that it's appropriate to ask the court system to do that, but what I would feel comfortable doing is passing that along to the Criminal Justice Working Group as something that the group could work on.
You just ask Kate.
Spare time.
Again, just to clarify, you're looking at a way that would combine all the different fiscal notes, the PD costs, the OPA costs, the trooper costs, the DA costs.
For each new judge.
I think, well, see if we can put that together. I think it's all broken down.
Yeah, I could probably get it. Just pull it out myself. I'm finished.
Any further questions for Carl?
Thank you, Chairman.
Is there anybody else? 2.4 million.
Yeah, 2.34, so I added a little digit.
Did you look at this?
No, it's 693.8.
Okay, as I indicated earlier, these bills will await the information and probably deal with the Senate bill, which will be coming over. So we'll put them aside right now. We have 2 other bills left over from Friday that...
I can't believe it's more than the salary. That just blows me away.
Yeah.
How long do you have to wait to get out of the legislature to become a judge? over the salary.
What, a year?
1.5 years.
I'm gonna write Peterson a letter.
1 year plus.
I gotta write Peterson a letter and tell him what he wants.
More.
1 year plus what, you said? 1 year past the end of your term. If, for instance, you resigned midterm, you still would have to wait for a year past the end of your term.
I thought it was 1.5 then.
No.
No.
Well.
The Constitution is 1 year. For, no,
actually,
not, that's not just for judges, of course, that's for any,
yeah,
any position that you voted, that you had the opportunity to vote on.
If you get unelected in November, it might be a year and a half.
474.
Yeah.
We've got a couple of months to go.
Mike?
474.
Now, which one? We've got many substitute video on.
474.
That's 474. Think up how hard 474 is this time.
If you have two versions of that bill, it's the 224A6 version.
Is that the one you want us to have? That's the only
that's
one.
Oh, okay. That's the one you did.
So for the purposes of discussion, I move the fine 224.
Before I rule on that, and I don't have any problem with it, but why don't you outline what it is just real quickly, what changes we've made?
Well, the amendments, Mr. Chairman, the title, we took out the court-appointed special advocate for it, and we took that out in all three places that it showed up. And we did something on the civil liability section.
Yeah, okay.
A couple of changes
there.
Well, the section 2 is new. That's the Taylor Amendment. And on page 3, as per the Clocks Amendment, we added subsection B. I think that's basically it.
Line 1, we put the word personally in. I got it settled.
That's page 3.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
It's just a matter of style. I don't like two adverbs following each other.
Where is that?
Look? On page 3, line 1, personally, civilly.
Right. Well, I have personally after liable.
Be held civilly liable personally. Well, that's better. You know, either personally liable in a civil action or...
Civilly liable personally?
I don't know. I
don't
like it at all. Goofy. I'd put personally liable in a civil action.
In a civil action.
I mean, just as a matter of style.
Okay. Well, all right now, this rule on Mr. Renberg's motion, you say you hear no objection, but we will adopt this as the working document for us, and we'll just.
With the Petty John
amendment. Yeah, and we'll just consider the Petty John amendment as part of that motion.
If there's no discussion, I'll move it out within the
debate. No.
I'm just trying to help.
I just want to discuss one thing briefly, and that is, I think this is fine. I think it's a good idea. I don't see a reason why not to try it. But I did read the information that was provided to us, a lot of feeling that, for instance, we were talking about, we've gotten lots of volunteers for this, and as a matter of fact, this little background sheet said that when they looked into it, they found that in these programs, they were flooded with volunteers in the beginning, and several months later, the supply is exhausted. Is there any thought at all that maybe we ought to do this on a 1 year or a 2 year pilot program to see if it works, or what, how do we undo it if we later decide that it's more than
I would suggest that if we have a sunset in there, I'm working with a bill now. It has to do with, remember when they had those signs that had to be in pharmacies that you could get generic drugs? That had a 2 year sunset. And it sunsetted and it fell between the cracks. Yeah, and what I would suggest is we put in here a letter of intent. Add a letter of intent with it that the Office of Public Advocacy shall make a report before the end of the first session of the next legislature to the Judiciary Committee or to the Speaker, whatever you want, as to how this is going.
Let me suggest that that's, I got reports piled up on my desk, and there's that three piles of them that high, and I'm just not convinced that that would do it. The other way that we could do it is, that's often done, is to divide the public advocacy statute into a mandatory functions and optional functions, so that if you look on page 1 of the substitute, page line 11, it starts out the Office of Public Advocacy shall, and then lists the things it has to do. And then on page 2, instead of adding a 6, add a new B that says the Office of Public Advocacy may, and then give some credit to the Office of Public Advocacy for being able to self-evaluate that, and if they decide they don't want to do it anymore, they don't have to come back and change the statute.
Then we'd have to make sub B, sub section C.
Well, yeah, you could read them, right.
Sure, that sounds like it.
Just make it optional.
Sponsor, what do you think about that?
That's fine with me. I read through the entire report that was presented to us.
I must say, Mr. Chairman, I'm a little surprised that the majority leader doesn't read all those reports as most of us do. No, the ones that are stacked up on your desk.
I did read the one that was about guardian ad litem.
Kind of surprised at that.
And I thought that report brought up some interesting comments, at least enlightened me a little bit to the issues, and it really emphasized the necessity for the training of these guardians, that if we're going to do this, that it's real important that the training take place, and perhaps by making it optional, then obviously the training is subject to funding.
Yeah.
For
example,
then you're up for review every year.
Yeah. The legislature gets squirrely on the funding, and the director can just simply decide that he's not going to do it if he can't adequately train them. If that's appropriate, I'd like to, I guess it's a conceptual amendment, it would, on page 2, delete subparagraph 6, and then have a new 4421410B, which would say the Office of Public Advocacy may develop and coordinate a program, and then renumber accordingly. B would become C.
Is that in the form of a motion?
Yeah.
Do I hear objection to that motion?
Hearing none.
It's adopted.
That doesn't seem the kind of thing we'd have to hold the bill for.
No.
If you would entertain?
Sure.
Okay. Okay. Were there some comments about this person?
What is this?
From France?
Something else?
No, that's just something we did in the house. That's already in there, Doug.
Yeah, but we got something. Price prepared some comment on it.
I think he's just explaining what he did. That's just on the CS.
More of a slander.
So I would so move.
Okay, is there objection to moving the bill out with individual recommendations? Hearing none, please go ahead and sign the report.
Excuse me.
I don't mean to talk out of turn, but I wasn't aware that this was going to be held over today.
Yeah, why don't you join us up the table so we can pick up?
Almost, maybe.
Close. Like professional wrestling, 2.5.
Out of order.
Yeah, for the record, Carla Forsyth, General Counsel to the Alaska Court System. Mr. Chairman, the court system had sent down a letter regarding this legislation, and you may have already discussed that at your hearing on the bill last week.
Yeah.
And if so, I apologize for redundant discussion.
Yes,
there was a relatively technical court system concern regarding the addition of the words court-appointed special advocates.
That's out.
We deleted all
thank
that.
Thank you, Mr.
That.
Chairman.
You didn't need a sponsor substitute.
No, I have not.
Thanks, Carla.
Never mind.
We do whatever the court system wants.
Thank you.
Send us a letter. That's done.
I renewed the motion. You can tell her that on the basis of your comments, we remove the mic. Okay.
Yeah.
Do I hear a motion? I've already ruled.
Forget it.
It's out.
I hear what you all have
to do. Yeah, we need to sign it. Now, we had one other bill that we were in the discussion stage on, and we can discuss that for a while now, and that's the other guardian bill.
Well, these used last year, these were all
object,
Nuremberg
right?
bills, if you'll note.
I love it. Shifting the emphasis. That's cool.
We just switched the sponsorship on these this year. 485 is the bill number.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Pidgeon?
In response to some questions by the majority leader, I thought it might be appropriate, and I'm just laying this out here to get the reaction of the committee on this bill, 485-S. After the word treated on line 22, if we inserted an additional phrase which would state unless the ward has indicated a desire that life-saving medical procedures not be withheld. And this has to do with a scenario where Representative Clarkson talked about a couple scenarios, and it's a little disturbing. It's probably mainly hypothetical, but if before I go into a coma, I say, whatever you do, don't pull the plug on me. I don't care what the odds are. I want to live if I've got any chance at all. And then you go into a coma, and then the guardians you point, and the guardian says, well, he's on his last legs. Let's not bother with him anymore. So that's the suggestion.
What is the language word?
It would come on line 22 after the word treated. And
before the semicolon?
Yes, and you would add another subphrase, which is going to make it even more complicated. But anyway, the phrase would read, unless the ward has indicated a desire that life-saving medical procedures not be withheld. And I'm not crazy about the language, but...
Would you be willing to say as clearly indicated?
Sure.
Just clearly indicated?
Clearly expressed.
How about stated?
As clearly stated.
Clearly stated.
A desire that, what is that? What's the rest?
I don't care.
That life-saving medical procedures not be withheld.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Of course.
Yeah.
Which is what they do now.
Well,
what is what they do now?
Well,
if I can just comment on the conceptual amendment here, that I guess where I'm heading with this is that's why there's court review now, is to make a judgment on questions like that. And since the bill is intended to take the court out of the decision, I mean, I obviously do support where your amendment's heading, but I think it points up why it is that there's court review now.
Well, are you speaking against the bill?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I'm having trouble seeing why we can't do it the way we're doing it now, which is to have a court review the circumstances before a judgment's made. Pretty serious step.
No, I mean, I agree it's serious. That's why I'm offering the amendment. If I could just grab the latitude, Mr. Chairman, it's just that I am not clear. It's not clear in my mind that the current system without this bill is working effectively. In other words, the scenario that's been represented to me is where you have an aged individual who is incompetent, and there are no family members around to make decisions about certain medical procedures, and so a guardian has that responsibility, and the guardian is presented with a case where the individual is clearly not going to be, his life is not going to be prolonged in any real meaningful sense. However, there is some heroic procedure where it's not even heroic, it's almost a standard procedure where they cut the person up and do all these terrible things, just trying to prolong their life a little bit. And in that case, they have to do it right now, and they don't have a mechanism, or they don't in fact go into court and lay all these facts in front of the judge. And the judge says, well, okay, yeah, that's fine. Take it under advisement. Meanwhile, this person, that they're obligated by law to just go in and do all these, things to these old people. And I think that's the typical example. And I'm sympathetic to the idea behind the bill, and my amendment is offered as a sort of way to take care of the sorts of contingencies the majority leader was talking about earlier.
Yep. Mr. Grimmer.
I very much agree with what Representative Pettyjohn has said. What this, and it's too bad we did not have, I don't think Jay McCarthy talked about this in this committee, but he did in the Hess, and the gentleman correct me if I'm wrong, that this bill, a lot of the impetus comes from people who are guardians, who don't want to always have to oppose these kinds of measures, the kinds of things that Representative Pettyjohn was just talking about. Under present law, the guardian may not consent to this, and that means it's a contested proceeding every time if there's a guardian appointed. They want to be able to consent in an appropriate case. So I think the bill is very necessary, guardians support it, the hospitals support it, and the language that you have suggested, I think, is right in line and very appropriate.
That's, the whole point of the bill is to put the guardian into the middle ground, be able to say yes or no. Mm-hmm. Right now, the guardian has no option.
Well, I would offer that amendment with the representative son's language.
Unless the ward has clearly stated the desire that life-saving medical procedures not be with her.
Right.
Yeah.
I'd offer that amendment.
Mr. Lockson, okay.
If we can continue the
chair.
Sure.
Yeah.
No
objection.
The, I guess it's not clear to me what happens now, but as I understood the testimony, as I understand what happens now under the statute, is the guardian refuses to consent and a petition is filed with the court on the matter. The guardian appears and the court decides.
Not always. I think the situation Sister Barbara, who testified in Hess, and the sisters from the hospital in Ketchikan, she's one of the big advocates of this bill, but the point is that the person is terminally ill from kidney failure and is going to expire in 2 days anyway. There's nothing can be done. The question is, can you put the room on a no-code for a heart problem? And the answer here is guardian has to say no. So when Code Blue comes rolling around, they got to run down and use all the heroic means they have to defilibrate, to
but
do whatever they can to hold this person alive for two more days.
You keep using the extreme example. But as I think, I thought this committee had learned with the living will bill, we're not talking about just no code. You're talking about maintaining somebody who is terminally ill by artificial means. Many situations, not just including no code. We're talking about putting people on machines and keeping them on machines. And this bill will allow someone to consent to pull the plug. That's a third party. Not the terminally ill person.
Under these criteria.
Under those criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it just seems to me that this committee has passed out a bill that deals with a situation where the terminally ill person gets to make his or her own decision, which I support. The issue is, it's going to be a third party that's going to make the decision that somebody's going to die. And that's fairly significant. I'm saying I think the existing system is that the judge decides that. And I think that what you're saying is a guardian decides that. Now, I asked the specific question yesterday about whether it had to be part of the authority of the guardian in the first place. The answer was yes, and I'm not sure that's correct. If you look at the remainder of 1326.150, there's two types of guardians, partial guardians and full guardians. A partial guardian has only the powers and duties respecting the ward enumerated in the court order, which is what we had understood the situation. A full guardian has, you can read it if you want, basically full authority.
Mm-hmm.
What that means, again, is that a full guardian who could have been appointed for a purpose other than making the decision about whether to pull the plug can in fact make that decision without the review of the judge that appointed him.
May I respond, Mr. We go to court. In most circumstances, there's just a private decision that's made, and that's what's done. And as a matter of fact, by the guardian and the doctor. Right now, the hospital.
But I need to understand this. I thought there wasn't a decision made on the part of the guardian because he was required to say no.
The guardian may say no, but as a practical matter, they, I think, wink at this in most cases. This is putting the guardians in a very tough spot. They legally would have to say no, but they just don't go into court in every case. The courts just would be overrun with these things. They don't do that in most cases. Dennis, am I right?
How many deaths do they?
Yeah, I think that's the situation. This basically allows the guardian to exercise his or her discretion as a practical matter. That's not a lot different.
Somehow, in here again, maybe I'm not really hot on how this works, Mr. Chairman, but the doctor has also made this decision someplace along the way. I mean, the doctor has his ethics and standards. I mean, it's just cutting someone
Luce, who may, in his mind, have an opportunity to live. So the doctors made the decision, or the committee, or whatever they run in the hospital, that these things here, that it prolong the dying process, and there's no reasonable expectation of affecting temporary or permanent cure. And it's an and, not an or. We changed that last time.
Mm-hmm. Did we finally change it?
Yeah, they changed the and, or to an and. I mean, I'm not, I think I understand the severity of the issue. I mean, it's life and death's a big issue, but the point here was to get the guardian in a position in the middle ground rather than on one side or the other. I guess, Fred, maybe the question is, how would that person have expressed it or stated it, or, I mean, it could be
any number of ways.
Any writing, in writing,
yeah,
verbally.
Yeah, I mean,
and that becomes a factual issue whether whoever wants to pursue it.
And do it in front of the judge. If I tell my wife, look, if I go into a coma, I don't care any about this living will stuff. I want to live, you know, period. And never pull the plug on me. Well, then that's an issue. Let the judge decide. You know? But that's the purpose of the amendment, because Representative Clarkson was making these hypotheticals. You know, and I think the worst hypothetical that you could get, I suppose, is where you've got a physician who doesn't really, you know, care too much about somebody who's, in his mind, not capable of being restored to a normal life, and this physician says, you know, this guy is gone, you know, just let him go. And then you've also got a guardian that says, well, the chances of him ever coming out of this with any brain activity are so small. And in fact, you know, maybe this person has a chance to live somehow. And under that scenario, I guess that's the worst case. Maybe this bill's not a good idea. But I just don't think that we've got that kind, those kinds of physicians and those kinds of guardians. And this, you know, the testimony of Sister Barbara was about real people right now who are you know, not hypotheticals, but real people.
Mm-hmm.
Old people who are going through their death agony, and instead of being allowed to die in some kind of dignity, are being subjected to all kinds of, you know, terrible medical procedures just to give them another few days of life. And it just, you know, on that kind of a judgment, I mean, I'll put my faith in the system to that extent, I guess.
Let me ask a question I raised the other day. Probably fully answered, but I didn't quite comprehend it. Right now, if a person doesn't have a guardian, then that, in most cases we're talking about a parent, or in the case of an older child, I mean, an older person, an adult child, for instance, might be one of our parents. As I understand this bill, this is simply putting the guardian in exactly the same legal position that an adult would have for his
right.
parents, or an adult would have for their child.
Right.
There's no difference, Mr. Chairman. Let us say it puts a guardian is to a ward, as a parent is to a child. That is not the same legally as an adult child is to a parent. So this. A guardian is the same as a parent to that ward, even if the ward happens to be the parent of the guardian. Let us say there is your parent is dying, and you're not appointed a guardian. So there's no guardian appointed for this person who is dying. This act doesn't apply, because it only applies where the court has appointed someone. In that circumstance, there is no law in this state. But about a year and a half ago, the Georgia Supreme Court said that at least with respect to a situation where an infant was dying and there was a parent and there was the court, that there's a constitutional right of privacy for the family to make that decision. And you don't have to go to court and get a court order. So presumably, the family would make the decision with the judge. Not the judge, with the doctor. It's only here where you have a guardian who's appointed and has legal liability and could be sued for malpractice or something, where this is needed to protect, because if you don't have this in there, then somebody could come along and say, you had no authority to do anything other than object. And that's, as Representative Sun said, why we need to allow the person to stand in the middle and to make an informed choice. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah,
Mr. Taylor?
This discussion comes awfully close to the one we had the other day out in the world. A fear, I guess, in the back of my mind is where you have a private hospital facility and a physician who has long-term care responsibilities and an economic decision. Economics plays a role in this, too. They're going to be doing heroic measures to resurrect people out of extremists. That's costing dollars to run that machine and to run the people up and down the hall and so on. And I just have that concern, I guess, too, that Mr. Pettijohn put it, I have a lot of faith in the system, but I also am jaded enough to worry a bit about some parts of that system. As it presently stands, as Representative Rumer has indicated, these decisions are being made by next of kin. We place the appointed guardian in the same position, but with no ability to say, yes, you can withhold extreme measures. So we have to then, this takes us one step further and says, yes, now that guardian can at least not refuse those additional services. I'm not comfortable with it, but I feel it's necessary to have it, or else the Sister Barbara scenario, which is a very real one, faces those good people out there every day. I'm not certain that a guardian is always appointed. It would seem there is no guardian sometimes, and then what do you do where is no guardian and is no family? Is the hospital then bound, and the doctors then bound to go forward with heroic measures while they wait for the public guardian to be designated or appointed by the judge and come in and give them a yes, you can pull the blood kind of a statement? I'm not certain.
They just do it. I think they just do it.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Dennis DeWitt. I'm president of the Health Association of Alaska. In response to the question about what happens in the instance where you are treating a patient who has no relatives and becomes incompetent, we try as best we can to get a public guardian appointed. The best I can say is, without absolute knowledge, but my understanding is that between the time you realize you have a problem, you begin to try and resolve it, and it gets resolved, you're basically, as they say, winging it. What you try and do is, as an institution, rely on the judgment, obviously, of the treating physician and the standards and protocols within your facility. And you're dealing with professionals who have a license and a responsibility to care for the patient to the best of their ability. I think that's what medical treatment is predicated on. And when a guardian gets involved, should that happen, then you're relying on the good judgment of a professional, medical professional, and someone who is professionally a guardian, who are both charged with the welfare of the patient. But in that middle area, you're basically winging it. The kinds of scenarios we've talked to you about, my judgment is that between the time a proceeding is instituted and the guardian's appointed, the problem usually resolves itself.
Nobody talks about it.
Mr. Fox, another question.
This just responds to several things. First of all, Representative Pettijohn referring to all the senior citizens that need this.
course, it isn't being advocated by them. Not one of them has contacted me in support of the bill, so not real clear
well
where the benefit lies there. The and I guess I really want to take this argument back to the living will bill. We very carefully excluded from the living will bill any provision that allowed a third party other than the individual who's terminally ill from making the decision to terminate the life support systems because of the euthanasia argument. This bill is that presents that euthanasia argument. It is a third person. It is, I think we've established, if you read the rest of 1326.150, it is a person who could have been appointed not for the specific purpose of making this decision, but a general guardian. This situation could very well not have been anticipated when the guardian was appointed, and you're going to let that person make the decision that person's going to die. I think the statute that's on the books now says you opt in favor of life. If you're trying to represent somebody, you know, that's what it is. You're trying to represent somebody and figure out what they think and what they want. And if you can't tell because they're incompetent, then you opt in favor of life. Seems to me that's a pretty good legislative policy. That policy is also reflected in the paragraph 2 right now. And I recognize the problem, but I think that the scenario that Representative Gruenberg has suggested, where there is a wink, is not only... I'm amazed if that's what happens. That's potentially murder, of course.
Yeah. You shouldn't be amazed, huh? I don't think you should be amazed.
No.
Not that, well,
no, really.
It's a significant policy problem, I think, if that's what's being produced. But I don't think the answer is to simply to give to third parties, who are not necessarily selected for this purpose, to be given the power to decide to pull the plug on. I just don't, I'm just not convinced that that's the answer.
May I respond to that? We're really generally, in most cases, looking at a guardian who will have been appointed not in a testamentary fashion, because those are generally willing a child to somebody, basically. But most of these are court-appointed guardians for elderly people. But that's really the general scenario here that we're dealing with. Or possibly somebody who is severely, profoundly developmentally disabled, who is maybe slightly over the age of majority, but with a very short lifespan. And so, in a circumstance like that, I think that whenever a petition for guardianship goes before the court, and this is generally the probate court that deals with probate matters and adoptions, at least in my judicial district in Anchorage, that master and everybody flat out knows that, and will know if this passes, that this is something that's very much within their contemplation. It is not just a little potential thing there, but it is something particularly with an elderly person that's going to be there for the rest of that person's life, and this is going to be one of the major issues that guardian is going to have to take. So it's not going to be just snuck in under the carpet, but it's going to be really well known.
Let me respond to that. First of all, I'm not implying any sneaking in. But what you are describing is a partial guardian.
No.
A guardian appointed for the purpose or the anticipation of the specific event we're talking about here. That's in B.
No, I'm talking about...
This applies to all guardians.
The
kind you just described,
I'm talking about a full
and the other kind where it never entered their mind that they might have to make the decision that we're talking about.
I said
we need to be going through the chair.
Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
If you have a partial guardian, as I understand it, the partial guardian only has those powers specifically delegated under the court order.
Right.
Okay. So, regardless of what this says, unless the court order specifically says you may consent to the withholding of life-saving forces, there's no authority in that partial guardian to do it because it would not be in that court order. So unless either A, you've got a partial guardian with this provision in the court order, or B, you're dealing with a general guardian, a full guardian,
this wouldn't apply. But the other thing, pardon me?
With a general guardian.
That's what I said. It does apply with a general guardian or when this provision appears in the court order. But the other thing, and the more important thing, was the thing that Representative Pettyjohn was saying. The fact is, everybody dies. The fact further is that many people die in a situation where there is a guardian. And we're not going to prevent that. These decisions will have to be made. The only question is whether we allow the guardian to exercise some discretion here. Because if we don't, the decision's made anyway. And the guardian is either breaking the law or going to court, and the judge is going to order it anyway. And you've got a situation that's not going to go away. You can't avoid these decisions.
I need to know, how fast is the court acting on a deal like this? Is it a matter of calling out the judge and he says, okay, or is there a bigger deal?
How many judges you have in your district?
Well, no.
And the judges aren't really set up to make really good decisions any better than the team will make, any better than the guardian and the doctor and the hospital will make.
You don't call the judge. First you call your lawyer, if I might, Mr. Chairman, if you can get a hold of him. And then you brief him, and you lay it all out to him, and he gets up to speed, and he finally figures it out. Then he goes to his secretary, and they get paper. You got to go to a judge with paper, you know. And it isn't that easy. It takes time, and the judges have got domestic violence stuff coming at them, and restraining orders, and God knows what. And it just, you don't just call up the judge, Mr. Chairman.
I'll make a quick search for it.
No.
I don't know how many other people have had these kinds of things. In all the years I've practiced family law, pretty much exclusively, I've never had somebody come to me and say, I am a guardian, I need to set up a hearing on whether we pull the plug. It just doesn't happen. It may happen with Jay McCarthy or somebody from the PD.
But in Carla, maybe you've had some experience in this stuff.
I have never, ever seen one of these things get into court. And that Georgia case was a super unusual situation. I haven't even seen it in the family law report.
Let me raise another question to you, and just calling on the legal expertise around this table. I understand why we're using the double negative here, because the assumption is that sort of represents sort of a middle ground. But I'm not sure it makes sense, because it says a guardian may not consent to the withholding of life-saving medical procedures. However, a guardian is not required to oppose the cessation of withholding life-saving medical procedures.
When?
Yeah, well, sure, I understand that. Yeah, when? Right. Well, I'm not sure if that's... If I was on a jury, or you know, this wouldn't be a jury, I guess, but if I was a judge, I wouldn't know how to interpret that. Because if you can't consent, then how can you not oppose?
I think the idea is, if I may, that there's some life-saving medical procedures that are not included within the language on lines 18 to 25. That would be the only reason I haven't worded that way. Right?
Yeah, Mr. DeWitt.
Mr. Chairman, I think we were trying to draw a very fine line between those procedures which were in fact life-saving, that is, they would sustain life for some period of time and relieve whatever was being treated, and the fact that those same procedures applied in certain circumstances were really not life-saving. And it's very difficult to say, for example, you can consent to the withholding of defibrillation because there are certain instances wherein that's appropriate, but there are a substantial number of situations where it's simply not appropriate. So the
Okay, would it make any more sense, though, than to say, however, a guardian may consent to the cessation of withholding of life?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, the only thing I can reflect to you on that is that a number of times I ran that by the public guardian, they were unanimously unhappy and unsettled with that.
Yeah.
They
that forces them to be part of the decision making.
And I'm just wondering on behalf of the patient, though, why isn't the right thing to do this way? The other way, all the person has to do is just be silent, and the other, and the, you know, the patient expires, which is probably, you know, what's the right thing to happen.
I think what they want to be able to do is to review it without having to get into medical decisions in an area where they feel tremendously uncomfortable. I think in my discussions with them, and I hope I'm fairly reflecting what they've shared with me, from my vantage point, I see very little difference. I am not a guardian. From their vantage point as guardians, they feel that receiving the information and evaluating it, as opposed to participating in the development of that, is a better position for them. It's a more comfortable position, and it's one that they feel, the kind of position they feel a guardian should be functioning in. It's very difficult for me to be real specific on it, because what we did is we used language that brought them a comfort level, and they're the folks that are in the front line dealing with it. So it, I would suggest that it's a preference of those that have to live there that at least our association would hope would be respected.
I have one last question, again, getting back to who these guardians are. Are these people that the court just sort of selects at random, or are they someone specifically associated with the family?
Mr. Chairman, yes, no, and maybe, I think, is the answer to that. At random, I think, is not...
Well, that's a good word, but I mean, it's selected from a group of people who are available for that purpose, and the judge calls on them, and maybe one person might represent seven wards.
There are public guardians. The public guardian for Juno, Monty Coleman, she has an office right over here in the court building. She's part of the system. There are, in addition to that, other individuals who might have a relationship to the ward who would be chosen as guardians. But I guess, you know, not to be facetious, but it's my understanding the court doesn't put out a notice. We have, you know, Mr. Jones, who needs a guardian, anybody wanting to apply. It's a much more closed activity than that. But it's not limited to, you know, two or three people.
Yeah, I don't know if it's appropriate that we have Mr. Petty Johnson amendment on the floor.
I moved it.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. That's right. We did not. Yeah. Yeah. Actually, I haven't voted on yet. Is that Mr.
Buck? I state my position, I guess. The amendment makes it go better, but I'm still opposed.
Well, then I ask unanimous consent.
It's objected to Mr. Petty Johnson amendment.
So I have to go to the committee.
You don't have to do that.
Okay, John, you're sick.
I'm a little nervous too, maybe not quite as nervous about it as you are. Okay.
What a motion.
It's in the hands of the committee.
I'll move to make a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations as amended.
And that includes the end.
We did that already.
We did that earlier. I just wanted to make sure the record was real clear. Okay, is there objection to the motion, Mr. Phillips?
No, I want to discuss something else.
Okay, well, we'll get to this. Okay, hearing no objection, I'll go to the committee within the
board. Don't worry.
Oh. Okay, you had another subject?
That's why I got it.
Yeah. Mike, I just want to discuss a few things in general that it seems to me, ever since I got home, it's becoming clearer to me now. It's my question, the motives of the chairman or the committee, but I think it's a matter of style. Now, we had two bills, the adoption bill and the living wills bill, and what's coming before us is tort reform and the lien law bill. Now, here we're sitting here in this Capitol building, which is a fairly secure place, in Juneau, which is a fairly secure place than the rest of the state, from my point of view. And it's all coming. Now I'm getting POMs and calls that they're not being heard. Living will, I wish we had the one witness that we had in Eagle River the other day, or Saturday, the other day here in the committee, because I think, I mean,
he brought up a good point. The witness is going to die probably 6 months from now. He had a, I don't want to get in the bill, but there was a place there that they could have pulled everything and he would have died right there on the spot. And he just warned the four of us to be very careful. So what I'm saying is the bills that are can affect literally almost everybody in the state, I think we ought to take it around the state. Personally, I'm talking not telecom, but be there in Anchorage and Fairbanks where it directly affects the person. Now these other things, these other bills that we're dealing with, like the for example, the adding of like two or four judges, I don't think we need to take that around, but because it doesn't affect that many people directly in their personal lives. And I'm sensing something out there that, at least for me, that we ought to try to reach out and go out there and see these folks on bills that affect them directly. The living wills and adoption bill are two that come to mind. And the tort reform is coming up, and the lien law, frankly, I don't think we ought to have a telephone. I think we ought to be there and make a survey and meet these people eyeball to eyeball. You may not like what I'm saying. I just have, I'm just feeling very uncomfortable now.
Well, I appreciate your sincerity in saying that, and we've got a real problem under the 120-day session. I realize that you recognize that, too. And I can't recall that I've ever turned anybody down on a teleconference if the conference system was available. But it's very difficult for somebody to travel, and also very expensive, but it's very difficult because it just moves all the other committees. Even if you do it on a weekend, it fouls up Friday afternoon schedule. For other committee chairs and everything like that, but but nevertheless, I recognize that literally what you're seeing, and I'll take that more into consideration. I don't know that we can do any traveling though, because we only have a little bit more than half of this session to go.
Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying. I don't want to do any more traveling. I have to in and out of this place, but it's beginning. It's clearer to me now that if we're going to be effective and we're affecting people's lives, we ought to go out there and find out how that affects. I mean, that guy came in there Saturday.
What are you talking? What are you talking about?
Well, I'm living will bill for one, but that's just an example.
Something on Saturday happened.
Oh, the four of us have a once a month public hearing for
constituent
meeting. And the thing is that these people do not hear about these bills until like Saturday. It's on in the newspaper, and it's a week already passed. The train's already passed them. They haven't had a shot at it. Now,
I've got to say this to me. We publish our schedule. Not just a week in advance, but usually 2 weeks. Mr. Taylor, then, Mr. Sun.
Yeah, go ahead. I just want to make the guys focus.
I sense exactly the same frustration, and I've traveled out every weekend but one so far. The tragedy there is that the public voted for a limited session, and as these bills come up for scheduling, and they get scheduled, and if people are interested, they're running into the LIO offices and finding out what those schedules are, and then they're desperately trying to find out where's the copy of the bill, and then a CS comes up, or a sponsor substitute comes up at the last moment, which dramatically changes the bill. The bill goes moving on through to the next committee, and especially with this fast track, they don't have any opportunity to get on top of it. During the interim, we start holding hearings in September just so we can catch up with the workload that we've got, so we're ready to go. Representative Sun has said at a couple of our constituent meetings, and he put it very well, I think, when he said the public voted for this, but they don't seem to realize the only people they cut out of the process was themselves. Because all the bureaucrats can afford to get here. All the agency people can afford to get here. But the ones we don't hear from is Joe Q Public out there. And it does make it very difficult for him. And I don't know what we as a committee can do, whether travel is the answer, I don't think it is, or whether more notification up front, I don't know what the answer is, but I sympathize with your concerns very much.
Well, frankly, as a representative, I don't want to get off base, and the Living Will is a good example, because there are people in there going from the test version, and we had to do a hell of a lot of explaining on the judiciary version. And once they've gotten the judiciary version down pat, I think most of the questions were answered. But how many more people out there don't know? Or they're still thinking, pass the version. I just want to make you guys aware that I sense something's wrong out there, and I want to focus in on it.
I appreciate your comment.
I just say that there's still some people figuring out the last Lands Act passed in Congress about, 6 years ago. You know, people didn't understand what it was when it happened. And I think there's a lot of stuff we do here that people aren't going to really understand what happened until 4 or 5 years from now. And, you know, just back to being the representative. But the issue is that you're traveling home and getting exposed to those persons. You're supposed to bring those opinions back to us.
But it's too late.
No, it's not. The House bill isn't law yet.
No, but
these are House bills.
Okay, but the living will bill, had I known that 2 weeks ago, I would have brought it up.
The living will bill went through the Senate last year.
I'm not arguing that, John.
And the other point is that eventually there's somebody in the state, 500,000 people, who always is going to want to have something to say before it happens. The system doesn't allow for it. And I'm just appreciative of the fact that so many of the members are doing so much traveling to the home front and bringing some of those issues back. But we're going to make the best decisions we can. We come back and change them.
Okay, but a lot of cases we make decisions. Look at it. There's nobody there, right there. We're making decisions. I want some wise.
Well, I know, but the living will. Had I known this guy's situation, I think I would have brought it up, and you know, we can discuss it. But
the bill is still not going to process.
Well, don't worry. I have two.
It was here for a year.
Yeah, I understand that. I'm not arguing. I said I'm not. Question the motives of this committee or any member, the same in style.
The bill that's on a fast track is a refinance bill for HFC.
Well, yeah.
Well, there is one opportunity for us that I frankly haven't investigated, although every time I think of it, I think maybe I should, and that is the last one down there has that video conference capacity, and it's a lot more expensive than teleconference. On the other hand, it's a lot less expensive than committee travel.
Like $1,800 in an hour.
It may not be much.
Yeah.
I think you'll find that it may be just about as cheap to go home as to use that.
Well, yeah. If that's the case,
2 hours,
you know,
probably.
But if it's, from time to time I look into it, it's always been too expensive for the particular bill I was talking about. Mm-hmm.
I'm saying is that, let's say I've been here 10 years, and this year it seems like the public is behind the power curve. Usually they're one step ahead of us. In my case. Pardon?
We finally got up.
I'm just
being ahead of the public.
I just think that we ought to look at that aspect. I mean, we're so involved doing our own work, we get the very people that we're...
I thank you for bringing it up.
I think it's something we need to talk about. The presumptive sentencing bill.
We can bring that around.
Bill on Friday. Nobody from Ketchikan got the file. Let me tell you, I had three lines burning for about an hour and a half when I come back up there, that if they do not get a chance to testify before this committee, I might as well not even come home.
And
I guaranteed them one more teleconference.
Okay, well, that's
another thing we schedule.
That's another good deal right there during the public not being involved. Now, we did have two or three people bring up for something sense. Sorry, Don, but they didn't like it. They were real angry. I just sent something out there, and it hasn't really occurred in the 8 or 9 years prior to this where the public's always trying to catch up. They're asking us for public hearings and all this other stuff.
Okay, your remarks are well taken, and we'll take them into consideration.
I'm taking these two files.
Yeah, I'm taking mine.